Cannon Car for Aerial 2. So,
did you present the necessity for fighting against the Japanese just in terms of this is another one of the king's enemies?
Yes. And I said, if we don't beat them, maybe they'll enslave all countries, including yours. Oh, no, they'll never come to Nigeria. We wouldn't allow that sort of thing. That was their response to that.
So, how did they react to being to the voyage to India?
How did they react to India?
To the voyage to India.
Well, most of them had never seen the sea at all, but they sort of acclimatized themselves. What surprised them and raised our prestige was to see their officers being waited upon by white stewards. You know, the only white people that they'd ever come across had been either army officers or NCOs or officials of some kind, not people who worked with their hands. So the white crew on the boat were quite a revelation to them. You know, it was really surprising to see white men who worked with their hands and white stewards who waited on their officer's table. And I think our prestige rose on this account. And they got on excellently with the crew of the boat. You could see them laughing and talking, exchanging possessions, and all very matey and pleasant. But some of them developed pneumonia and died. I think about half a dozen in my battalion.
From being at sea?
Yes, I think the cold at sea. And I don't think pneumonia was very common in Nigeria. The marvels of the sea, like a few whales, dolphins, flying fish, interested them at first, but they soon took everything for granted. They were very adaptable.
How did they get on once they got to India?
Well, they never thought much of the ordinary Indian peasant, or coolie, and that was the only Indian they ever met. They could see immediately that they were members of a subject race, and they rather looked down upon them. For the first, as a start, their own African physique was a good deal more robust than that of the Indian, and they didn't think much of the Indian at all. They rather disdained him. And I remember shortly after we got to Bombay and we were travelling by train up country to our camp, one of the Africans was selling an Indian on the station a watch which he'd managed to obtain for himself in Durban on the voyage. And just as the train was pulling out of the station, the Indian rushed after him and said, "But this watch, it does not go." And the African said, "No, if it had gone, I wouldn't have sold it to you."
Did he get his money back?
Yes, no.
So, can you tell me when you actually started the preparations for going into combat in Burma?
Yes.
Can you tell me about them?
Well, when we got to Bombay, we heard that our particular all-Nigerian brigade was to leave the 81st West African Division. When I say the 81st, you must bear in mind that everything in war had numbers which bore no relation to anything. In fact, it was the 1st West African Division. There weren't 80. In fact, there weren't any. It was the first and only, to be followed later by the 82nd, which made it the made that one the 2nd West African Division. Anyway, we were to leave the 81st Division and become Chindits under General Wingate. This we heard in Bombay, and this had a galvanizing effect upon us. Because we thought, blimey, you know, we'd read about Wingate in his first expedition. He was a very famous chap. And we rather wondered whether we were up to this sort of thing, being completely green troops. And from then on, we never saw the rest of the 81st West African Division at all. So we trained in the jungles of the central provinces, as they then were in India. We trained to become Chindits, and we trained with other Chindits. We didn't see a great deal of our Chindit comrades, but we saw something of the other battalions, Gurkha and British, and we learned to march in those terrible heavy packs carrying about 70 pounds and how to jungle tactics, how to lay ambushes, and so on. Very tough training it was too, because Wingate's idea, and a very good one, was that training must always be made tougher than anything you were likely to encounter in Burma itself, in the way of physical hardship. And I think he was right.
And he did make it tougher, did he?
Oh yes, our training was very tough indeed.
Did Wingate come round himself?
Yes, indeed. I only saw him once myself, and he was very impressive talker. He was so impressive that after he finished talking, there wasn't one of us but wouldn't have followed him anywhere. We understood perfectly clearly exactly what he intended to do in Burma, how he intended to impose his will on the Japanese, and how the Japanese would react. And he made a most tremendous impression upon us. In fact, he'd made this impression long before we ever saw him, because he dominated our every thought. Our every military thought was, what would Wingate do? He had this tremendously strong personality which managed to impress himself even on people he'd never seen. And so, we felt it an honour to be attended. Most of us did. We scoffed at it, of course, but secretly we felt it was a fine thing.
So when he spoke, what, apart from his clarity and force of personality, came through?
Well, that's hard to say. When I first saw him approaching, he looked totally insignificant. A little man, as scruffy as ourselves, hatless, rather wolfish looking, slightly stooped. And I didn't know that he was Wingate. When he came a bit closer and I saw the DSO ribbon with two rosettes, I was most surprised. But as soon as he began to talk, he immediately assumed tremendous authority. It radiated from him. And his thoughts seemed almost visibly to leap ahead of his words. It was a most impressive talk. And we were all tremendously impressed. We never forgot it, any of us.
Was he a scruffy-looking person?
Well, he didn't take great care about his appearance. But he had his hallmark, as is well known. He used almost always to wear a battered old Woolsey helmet. You must have seen photographs of him wearing this. He was generally rather unkempt-looking.
Was he regarded as a great eccentric?
Well, yes. I mean, we didn't know personally of his eccentricities, but we'd read about them in the papers and so on, about how he sometimes went about, I think, in the Sudan or Ethiopia, dangling an alarm clock from his wrist to remind people of the passing of time and that sort of thing. And his liking for turtle's eggs or raw onions. And of course, in many ways, I'm sure that he was eccentric. And he was, we understood, very rude, especially to his military superiors. Consequently, very few of them liked him at all. And it was said, whether with truth, I don't know, that the brass hats in Delhi and so on were really quite pleased when he was killed in this air crash in March 1944. Because they thought, well, let's get rid of him. We don't want any more Wingates around.
Did you ever personally come across anybody who disliked him?
No, I didn't myself, but there were a few in his force who were rather less than enthusiastic about him. But the vast majority thought the world of him and would have followed him anywhere. There's no doubt at all.
What about the Nigerians? What did they make of him?
I think he was too far beyond them, really. They only knew what we had told them about him.
How did the Nigerians react to the Chindit-style training?
Very well. A lot of the British Chindits thought, oh, well, this is the natural country for Nigerians, jungle, forest, you know. They're obviously natural jungle fighters, which, of course, was complete nonsense, because 80% of our soldiers came from semi-desert country, or sort of bush savannah, and not jungle at all. The Nigerians who lived in the jungles, the real equatorial jungles, were those of the south. And we had very few of those because it was thought that tribes like the Yoruba and the Igbo would not make good fighting soldiers. What on earth the grounds for this belief were, I don't know, but this was the case. So the policy was to enlist northerners only, who were far from natural jungle fighters, any more than the Japs. The Japs weren't natural jungle fighters, but they soon made themselves into very skillful ones. So it was complete nonsense to say, ah, the forest suit the Nigerian soldier. They didn't know anything about the forest, any more than we did.
But they adapted to it easily?
They adapted themselves very well to it. Instead of trying to fight against the jungle or the forest, as a lot of us did, either consciously or subconsciously, they just surrendered to it. They took it in their stride. They made it their environment.
When did you actually go out to Burma?
I flew in myself on the 5th of April, 1944, with an advance party for the battalion in a Dakota aeroplane, which took off just before dark and landed at a big defended position in the middle of nowhere on the railway and road between Mandalay and Michinar. The name of this fortress, you might call it, was, the code name was White City, and it was commanded by the most famous Chindit of all, next to Wingate, Brigadier Michael Calvert.
What impression did Calvert make on you?
Oh, a very marked impression. He was a very fine commander. He was the finest field commander that I ever came across.
What was so good about him?
He was determined. He was enterprising. He was brave. And he had a very strong and magnetic personality. He's been described as flamboyant, but he wasn't flamboyant. The word flamboyant conveys to me somebody slightly inclined to show off, and there was nothing showing off whatever about Calvert. He talked quietly. He always gave his orders in a conversational rather than a peremptory tone. In fact, he was often quite vague in conversation. But he had this gift for leadership, which is a gift very hard to define, but Calvert had it to the nth degree. And his soldiers would do anything for him, and did. In my opinion, though of course my personal experience is slight, but from all I've read, he's one of the finest soldiers to have come out of the last war, without any question.
He got the nickname Mad, I think.
He wasn't, yes. Well, the name Mike seems to lend itself to being called Mad, like this mercenary, Mad Mike Hoare. But he wasn't mad at all. Nor impetuous.
So when you got to White City, what was it like?
What was it like? Well, we landed, of course, well after dark. And our job was, the Hell Battalion was, at that time, the idea was that it was to form part of the garrison of White City. And we were there, A, as an advance party to have a look round before the rest of the battalion arrived the next day, and B, we had a platoon of Africans with us to help unload from the Dakotas, which had landed that night, 25-pounder guns for the gunners in White City, who'd been put onto the Dakotas in bits, and the African platoon were to help unload them, which they did that night. And when I collected all the party together at about 3 a.m, we didn't know quite what to do. There were grenades and light automatic fire about a mile away or less, and we'd no idea who was doing the firing or why or whether the Japs would be upon us. Every figure that passed us in the gloom, we wondered whether they were our own or the enemy, whether they were on our side or the other side. But eventually I got all the party together and we slept under the wing of a crashed glider on the edge of the Dakotas Strip, White City itself being about 1/4 mile away across the paddy. And next morning, Calvert's Air Force officer led us in to the fortress itself, through the minefield, through the rusty old rails of Dannet wire, and into the fortress. And there we were given a position which we had to dig near a platoon of the South Staffordshire Regiment. And there we were for about a week. That very night, the Japs attacked White City in force after dark. And we all stood to, peered anxiously into the night. Every time an orange flare went up from one of our 2-inch mortars, we looked round to see whether we could see a Jap, either looking like a Jap or looking like a bush, but we didn't. And in fact, our part of the fortress was never attacked. All attack was about 200 yards away, but it made a very great noise. And it went on for several hours. And before the attack started, in the afternoon, we were subjected to a bombardment from a huge mortar the Japanese had, which was known in White City as the coal scuttle. And it fired a most tremendous projectile, about 5 feet long, which went off with tremendous noise and scared the life out of us all. It was apparently a 5.9 mortar, somehow obtained from the Germans after the First World War. I think it was the largest mortar used in the Second World War. And this was our first introduction. And by that time, we hadn't dug any holes. Oh, the British officers hadn't. There were 3 British officers, including myself, with this advance party. So we leapt into an excavation about 12 feet by 6 feet, full of unsavory tins used as a sort of rubbish hole, which didn't provide very satisfactory cover, but it was better than nothing. And there we stayed while this bombardment went on for about an hour. And eventually we heard voices round us on the hill and no more bombs came, so we climbed out and went to see how the Africans had got on about 50 yards away. They'd half dug their holes, but they had no overhead cover. One of them had his pack, which he left on the lip of his hole, more or less demolished by a shell, but nothing else. So they were undamaged. I should have mentioned that before the night attack and after the mortar bombardment, there was also an air attack from about half a dozen Zero fighters who dropped a few ineffectual bombs on the airstrip and then flew over us machine gunning. But they weren't particularly alarming, nothing like as alarming as a mortar. And they didn't do any damage to us, or as far as I know, to anybody else. And then there was a pause of about 3 hours till it got dark, and then we had the night attack. So really, it was a very abrupt introduction to war. In 24 hours or less, from peace without a shot or without an enemy within hundreds of miles, that suddenly there we were in the thick of it, in a very short time.
How long did you stay at White City?
About 10 days. Oh, no, I don't think it's long. I think 8 or 9 days. Once we got there, no battalion arrived. In fact, it turned out that we were the last Dakota into White City, and none other came because of these Japanese night attacks. And after about 7 days, I went every day to brigade headquarters, the brigade major being a very old friend of mine, to try and find out what had happened to our battalion, and couldn't find out anything at all. Until about the 8th day, I suddenly saw our brigadier and brigade major arriving, getting out of a light plane. The light plane strip was in a little re-entrant within the defences, quite close to our position. So I dashed down the hill and got hold of the brigade major to ask him what the hell was going on. And he said that as well as the Japs' attacks on White City, bad weather in Assam had prevented any aircraft being able to take off. But he said the battalion had flown in the day before, and they'd landed at a stronghold called, codenamed Aberdeen, 20-odd or 15 miles away, and were marching through the jungle towards White City and should arrive the next day, or if not then, the next but one. However, they didn't arrive until eventually, on I think the 9th day, a chap called Jerry Bladen, who was the reconnaissance platoon commander of our sister column. By that time, I should have mentioned, each battalion had been divided into two columns, because the unit of Wingate's force was not the battalion, but the column. Anyway, this chap arrived with two Africans. He'd had great difficulty in getting into White City, because every time he tried, he was fired at. And he told us that our two columns, the two columns formed the 7th Battalion, were lying up in the jungle about 7 miles away, all their wireless sets having unaccountably failed, so that the commanding officer had no idea. He'd heard all the noise at night from White City, but he'd no means of knowing whether the Japs or ourselves were in possession. So he'd very sensibly sent Jerry Bladen to find out. So, obviously, our next step was to, had to be, to rejoin our battalion, which we did, led by Jerry Bladen. And just before we left White City, finally, we heard that our battalion was now no longer to form part of the garrison, but was to join Calvert as part of his striking force, because he intended to take several columns and move south and southeast in order to attack the Japanese investing White City. And we were to join him in this, which we did.
Well, I can't go into all the details of the operation.
But I think I should mention now that the two columns into which our 7th Battalion was divided were known as 29 Column, which I commanded, and 35 Column, commanded by a Welsh Guardsman called Peter Vaughan, who was also commanding the battalion. So 35 was, so to speak, the senior column, and 29, which I commanded, the junior column. Now, with the rest of the striking force, we occupied a deserted village within range of the Japanese besieging White City, or attacking White City. I mustn't say besieging it, because White City, of course, was supplied by air, so there was no question of being short of food or ammunition or anything of that sort. Anyway, there we were at this base in Thai An, and the Lancashire Fusiliers and Gurkha City's force attacked next day the nests of Japanese lying in the jungle, and Peter Vaughan with his column went off to attack Morlu, which was a village occupied by the Japs about a mile and a half south of White City. And there the Nigerians did very well in their first engagement. They killed a lot of Japs, they occupied half Morlu, and they were recalled by Calvert at nightfall. But my column did very little. We had to occupy a village called Pon Hon, of no particular significance, as a sort of foot on the ground, slightly in advance of Thayang. And a lot of wounded Gurkhas came in through Pon Hon the next day, and we sent them back by bullock cart to Thayang, where they'd made a light plane strip to evacuate them. And at nightfall, we received orders from a galloper